My name is Jackie Devoy. I'm a freelance journalist. I've been writing for the last 40 years, almost 40 years now. Started out on teenage magazines and women's magazines, and later moved on to the national papers. And then almost 6 years ago, all that changed a bit when the faux pandemic began. And I knew what was happening, having watched Event 201, which I think a lot of other people saw as well, in November of 2019, which basically laid out the blueprint of what they were going to do. As soon as it started in March 2020, I thought, oh, they're actually starting it now. I thought that would be in a couple of years' time, you know. But
well, look, you hang on. You've been in the business a long time, a bit like me, a bit longer, actually. So can you just give us your sort of long view on how media, the press in Britain has changed over that time?
Well, stories that I used to get published very easily back in, even back in, like, say, 2016, 2017, I used to do a lot of stories about the injuries and deaths that various vaccines caused back then. And it wasn't a problem to get those sort of stories into the paper. In fact, they were quite keen to publish them. But obviously, as soon as this started in 2020, all that changed. And because I could see that the narrative that the media were putting out there was incorrect, and there were some big problems with it. When I started pitching stories to them, they didn't want my stories. They wanted to stick to the narrative because my stories were counter-narrative, you see. So, for example, the first story I sent them was when I was looking on the government website and saw that the coronavirus, as they were calling it back then, had been downgraded to a not high infectious disease. So I thought, well, that's good news. That's going to stop everyone worrying, because, you know, a lot of people were worried because the media were, like, really pushing this deadly virus narrative. So when I saw that, I thought a little bit naively, it would look naive on the surface, knowing what I knew. But I just put this story out there to all the newspapers saying, look at this on the government website. It's not dangerous. It's not a killer virus. No one's going to die from it. I didn't say at that point, you know, if it even exists, but I just took it for, you know, there was something out there, and whether it was just rebranded flu or whatever, but it wasn't going to kill people. And in fact, around that time, people like Chris Whitty were getting up anyway and saying to the public on the news, don't worry about it. You know, if it affects anyone, it will affect the elderly, you know, like any kind of flu or winter respiratory virus. So don't worry about it. But people were already in a state of fear by then. And it's like they couldn't hear anything that was being said that wasn't, you know, kind of terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, my experience as someone that really started in the late 80s in journalism as a freelancer, and then working for a while at the BBC doing research, I mean, really, like, I suppose, coal-faced journalism, digging out new stories in London with a big audience, was that slowly but surely, it seems to me, from those days, everything seems to have been much more controlled. So for a while, you know, we could get almost any story in. Maybe if it was something which was morbid or depressing, that the editor would just say no, although they seem to like that stuff now. But it does seem to me that there's been a sort of consolidation of the whole editorial process, where it's almost like you can flick around 20 channels and you'll see almost the same stuff everywhere.
Yes, well, that is something I noticed back at the start of the century. That, you know, once upon a time, back in the sort of 70s and 80s, all the papers were very different. They were running different stories. You know, one represented the Tories, one represented the Liberals, one represented the Labour Party, and they all had a very different tone. But by around the year 2000 or early 2000s, I started noticing, hang on, that story in The Guardian is exactly the same as the one in the Daily Mirror, like word for word, like they were just printing a press release. And I don't know if it was just laziness or whether this was some new thing that had been brought in, that they're all kind of merging into one big amorphous blob of a newspaper. That's what it felt like. And I kind of stopped reading the papers back then, although I would write stories for them if and when they found my stories acceptable, which they did back then, so I was doing all kinds of human interest stuff. That was kind of my main area back then. Anything that I found interesting, I would think, well, someone else will find that, other people will find this interesting as well. So I'd write up the stories and get them out. And yeah, I was doing really, really well, but back at that time, and selling lots of stories. And of course, when it came to 2020, all that changed.
Well, look, we're going to get into your book in a minute, but let's just talk a bit about COVID first, because I don't know, did you catch anything at the time? Because I certainly had a very nasty flu, December the 21st or 2nd, 2019. I was in a hotel room. I thought to myself, if I'd be 10 years younger, 10 years older, this possibly could have killed me. I also had a close friend of mine who was in his early 80s died in December. Basically, just he was trying to get to a bathroom. It was outside, and he just literally died on the ground trying to get to it. That's how some people were affected by this. I heard a crazy tale from a producer at the BBC in Bristol here that the 17th of December 2019, a crew came back from Switzerland and spread a very nasty flu around the BBC here in Bristol, which may have then spread elsewhere. But I mean, there is obviously a bit of dispute over whether there was any virus at all, whether viruses are exist or dangerous at all. What's your thoughts about it all?
Well, you're telling those stories to the wrong person. What I've just heard you say there, with no disrespect to your poor friend who died, that was all what an awful way to go. You had your annual detoxing, like we all have. Sometimes we have really major, nasty flu, or whatever you want to call it, or a cold, or whatever. Your poor friend was, in his 80s. He was elderly. He might have had some underlying conditions. I don't know. I don't know any details, obviously. And as you yourself just said, the last story was a crazy tale. We all hear crazy tales all the time as journalists, don't we? They're not all true. But yeah, so I might not be like you.
Well, I will say that's definitely it was definitely true, that one. What I'm
Those.
saying is, the reason I say it's crazy is because it's like this was before COVID, well before COVID, and it's at the BBC, so you can expect a dodgy BBC would be not wanting to report if they brought a virus back to the city that had then begun to spread and kill people.
Yeah, but you
If
see,
indeed you thought it did. But anyway, I want to get your views on,
yeah, I'll tell you.
What actually was going on then?
Well, my view on the whole contagion myth, which it is, I don't know if you've read The Contagion Myth by Dr. Tom Cowan, very good book, is I have studied this for a long time now, and germ theory is a hoax. Germ theory, meaning there are pathogens floating around in the air, and you can catch them, but the person next to you won't, but everyone else will, and some will, some won't. That whole theory was a hoax, and Louis Pasteur, who came up with that theory, actually said on his deathbed that it was a hoax, and that he had been brought in to promote this idea that you can just catch an illness by breathing or by standing next to someone who's got a cold. That's been disproved over and over and over, with many, many experiments and tests over the last 100 years. I have worked out that I'm lean more towards terrain theory, which is basically how your health is depends on your inner terrain. I cannot catch your bad health any more than I can catch your good health. You don't catch colds off people. There's been masses of experiments where they've actually, got snot from one person and or 500 people and stuck it up other people's noses or whatever, or injected it into them. There's been many, many experiments you can look into, and people don't catch anything. That you don't catch that sort of thing. It comes from your own toxicity. So say you've spent the year, abusing yourself with bad food, smoking, drinking, whatever. Also, pharmaceutical drugs affects your inner terrain for the worse. And then at the end of the year, you suddenly start feeling unwell. Well, that's hardly surprising. Your body is desperately trying to get rid of the toxins. With me, it tends to happen twice a year, depending how good or bad I've been. the severity depends on that. But usually, once in the summer, once in the winter, I get a flu-like thing. I must say, this year's was more like just a bad cold. So I've obviously not been too misbehaved. But the year before, I was stuck in bed all over Christmas, and I hadn't been out socializing or anything anyway. So even if you did believe that you could catch it off your next door neighbor or the man in the bank, I hadn't been out anyway. So
Well, look, you sound very sure about this.
I'm
I
very
mean,
sure because I've
we've
read so
had, I
many.
mean, I'm just thinking of situations with our weekly program where we've had a guest come into the studio who has maybe got, in fact, sometimes it's Martin Summers, is my better half, protagonist, and commentator in there. He'll come along and start coughing and spluttering, and then the next day I'm starting to get a tickly throat. And so you're saying this is all just coincidence?
Number one could be coincidence. There are lots and lots of reasons why people appear to catch things off people. I mean, it's a huge subject, and there's a lot of information that you can read on it. There's psychological reasons. There's also, if there's a group of people in the same environment, they might be eating the same foods, drinking the same drinks, having the same lifestyles, like in the family situation or whatever. And if it was true that these detoxing processes were contagious, then why do you get families of eight living in one house where two people get ill and the rest don't? Do you know what I mean? So there's many, many sides to this, and it's a very
Well,
interesting.
I mean, there is another thing that, what you're saying makes me wonder is, a lot of people are very reluctant to go and visit the elderly if they've got a cold or a flu, something like that,
Yes,
because they're
absolutely.
worried that they may catch it, and actually, they could cause them serious trouble.
Yeah, well, this is the belief that they played on with the COVID debacle. They knew that the majority of people that believe that you can spread illness, and you obviously there are certain things you can catch, like infectious diseases such as herpes, for example, because that's a sort of skin-to-skin contact thing. But again, you're not going to get that by breathing on someone. But
So you can't catch things by airborne bugs.
no, absolutely not.
Right.
There's no
Well,
such
I
thing
mean
as an airborne bug.
that's a pretty strong statement, for anyone that's going to visit their 90-year-old granny with flu.
We would all, every single person in the world would be dead by now. No one would be alive if everyone caught everything that's, and it's all floating around in the air that we breathe, So, the guy who actually started talking first about terrain theory is Antoine Béchamp, another guy called Claude Bernard. In the 19th century, actually, they actually said that disease does not come from germs attacking a helpless body, but like I said, the internal environment, the terrain of
Yeah,
the.
well, I mean, it's an interesting. I think it's most important, and I do this all the time, to re-examine history, to look at the way that certain assumptions are there, in the public mind that may not be true. But anyway, look, you've just come out with this Murder by the State book, and this isn't really about that. It's much more to do with the various protocols, the orders that were given down through the care homes and the health service. So can you just tell us a bit about the book?
Yeah, God, you've done a big leap there. I've done a lot more work in the last. I've made three films in the last 5 years as well. But anyway, yeah, okay. The most recent thing I've done is I had this book published. It's called Murdered by the State. It's kind of grown from the films that I've made. So I can tell you about those if you like, or do you want to talk about the book?
Well, let's just start with the book, and we can have a look at the films afterwards.
Yeah. Murdered by the State is a compilation of real life stories narrated by relatives of the victims of involuntary euthanasia, right? This is a very hard thing for people to wrap their head around if it's the first time they've heard it. But because I've been dealing with it for the last five, nearly 6 years, I find it quite, I find it quite easy to talk about, whereas it's a very difficult, painful subject for most people to even think about, let alone talk about.
But hang on, there's been lots and lots of talk about this whole idea of euthanasia through the assisted dying. They're trying to make it legal now.
My book is about involuntary euthanasia. It's not about going to a Swiss clinic and booking yourself in to help someone to have someone kill you.
No.
This is involuntary euthanasia, which means there's no consent involved from the family or the
Well,
victim.
look, listen, one of the big concerns is that for a lot of elderly people, that consent can be manufactured through a few bits, people signing various bits of paper. Oh, yes, that they do want to die.
Yeah, I mean, they cannot bring in the assisted dying bill. I was going to say they're dying to bring it in, but they are desperate to bring it in. And it's being, that they've got old Esther Ranson being, the face of assisted dying, and she's been harping on about it for years. She's had like stage four lung cancer for about the last 3 or 4 years, and saying, oh, if only I could get assisted dying, well, she's welcome to. She can go over to Switzerland and get it, or one of the 10 other countries where it's legal. And we look at Canada and the whole MAID program. What a slippery slope that's been. There's something like 6% of all deaths in Canada now are assisted suicide, I prefer to call it, because that's what it is. And they're pushing it and promoting it on people who are just who aren't terminally ill. They're allowing children over 12 to consent to it. They're allowing people who are depressed, and who are depressed because they haven't got any money. So the people who are poverty stricken are actually going for it. They're suggesting it. There was a story recently, just one woman who went to talk to her GP about, I don't know if they're not called GPs in Canada, but her doctor about breast cancer treatment. And one of the options was euthanasia. So it's like, well, you could have chemo, you could have nothing, or you could just go and kill yourself. And that has become.
I suppose it could be considered by a kind of Dr. Evil treatment, couldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it could, but it is a terrible, so it's open to abuse, as you mentioned, and it has been abused. And there's been some absolute horror stories that have come out from around the world where it is legal. There was the story in Belgium. I think that this guy was actually using one of those suicide pods, like a little kind of space age looking capsule thing that you lie down in. And then, but when they found this woman who had volunteered herself, I mean, she wanted to have to be euthanized, she had strangulation marks around her neck, and it came to pass that the doc, she didn't die. She didn't die from the drugs that he'd given her, so he strangled her. And the
Oh
stories
God.
that
I
I've
mean,
heard.
there's one born every minute, as we used to say. They'll always find somebody to try this kind of crazy technology out. They look like something that you might find in some sort of Nazi torture chamber, these
Exactly.
cocoons. But anyway, back to your case studies, because it'd be, I think, interesting for people to see if anything of those case studies resonates with their own experience.
Yeah, so it all began when my dad was in a care home back in 2020, and I started to discover things. That was the first time I'd heard of a DNR. They'd said they phoned me just to go through his paperwork to make sure everything was in place, and they said, "Oh, of course, there is a DNR in place." And I'm about then saying, "Oh, what's a DNR?" I said, "It's a do not resuscitate order." My dad was 76 at this point, and he wasn't terminally ill. He'd had a stroke, so he'd just gone into a care home. I reckon for a few months until he felt better, and then he'd come home again. So when the council called me and said they wanted his council house back, I went, "No, he'll be out in a few months. He'll be fine." So back to the DNR, I said, "Oh no, we don't need one of those. Isn't that just for terminally ill people, from the sounds of it?" And they said, "Oh no, everyone in a care home has to have a DNR now." And I was like, "What the hell?" And that was the case. There were blanket DNRs in 2020 put on everyone, not only everyone in a care home, but anyone going into hospital over a certain age or with a certain condition. So at that time, there were DNRs being put on people over 60, in some cases over 50 in some hospitals, people with mental health issues such as schizophrenia or anxiety or anything diagnosed along those lines. Autistic children had DNRs put on them. So basically, it was anyone who they deemed was not worthy of being resuscitated should they stop breathing for whatever reason. So I argued with my dad's care home, and they said, "Oh no, we've got to keep it on." I said, "Well, no, I definitely want that removed. Let me speak to the manager," which I did, and I also spoke to a doctor that was visiting the care home. And it was at the time of the window visits, and I had a meeting with a doctor who was standing in my dad's room behind my dad, so my dad's in the middle of us, and I'm trying to talk to him through a a window that's opened about a quarter of an inch. I don't know if they're worried about letting the COVIDs out or the COVIDs floating in from the outside. But anyway, they opened the window a tiny bit so I could barely hear the doctor. My dad sat in the middle of us saying, what are you two talking about? And I said, we're talking about DNRs, Dad, do not resuscitate orders. He's like, oh yeah, I know what they are. He said, well, if you stop breathing, you stop breathing. I don't need to be brought back. And I'm like, come on, Dad, whose side are you on here? I'm trying to get rid of the DNR, not have you want one. And he's like, well, I said, look at it this way. If they put a DNR on me, if I was in a care home and I stopped breathing, I choked on my breakfast and stopped breathing, would you want them to resuscitate me? And he went, well, of course I would. And I said, well, I feel the same about you. And he went, oh, okay, I get it. No, you're right. No, I don't want one of those. So you just have to kind of, he had slight dementia at this point because of the stroke. Well, I don't think it was dementia. I think it was side effects of the drugs that they were giving him that made him a bit woozy in the head. But anyway, they didn't remove the DNR, even though the doctor said they would do their best. And I spoke to his GP and they said they'd do their best. But anyway, I eventually got him out of the care home. But in that time, then I started looking at, I started talking publicly about care homes because my dad, and I actually wrote a series of articles, four articles for the Telegraph, actually. That's when they were still using me right kind of at the start. And one, the first one was about how I sprung my dad out of the care home. I decided that I didn't want him imprisoned in a care home anymore. So I went and I wrote to them and just said, I'm coming tomorrow at 3 p.m. Have my dad ready. I'm taking him home. And I said, if you don't, I'm going to take you to court for false imprisonment of my dad and for violation of his and my human rights. So have him ready. So I drove up there for 3 o'clock. Amazingly, he was there, all his things packed. He's in his wheelchair. And I get him into the car thinking, oh my God, I can't believe they've actually, and they were smiling and happy, and waving him off. And I got him home and he started to get a kind of weird survivor's guilt by the second day. He started saying, oh, maybe I should go back. And I'm like, Dad, why do you want to go back? And he said, because what about the others? Can't we get them out as well? And I was like, Dad, I can't get them all out. What would I do with them? And he was saying, oh, but they're going to miss me. And I said, yeah, they will miss you. And he was like, and what am I supposed to do now? I'm home, sit here and look out the window. I said, well, you.
Well, I mean, there is that side of it. At
Yeah,
least he's got some contact with others there, and
well, yeah,
the
that's the thing.
social side of it. Did he have? Did was he able to chat with other residents?
He didn't like them. He said they were all mad. But when he got home, he's
But
got
then
loads
he, you're saying he was in a bit of a state of dementia too.
of slight, but I think that was drug induced because when I got his drugs altered at home by his GP, that seemed to disappear. They were giving him insulin injections for diabetes. I just changed his diet. Within 3 weeks, took him back to the GP and she tested him and said he doesn't need the insulin injections anymore. How did you do it? And I said, I put him on a vegan alkaline diet recommended to me by a friend. And that friend happened to be caring for my dad as well at home, looking after him at 24/7. And so he made sure he had really good food, really healthy food, vegan and no acidic food at all, just alkaline. And it gets rid of diabetes. So when I told the GP that, she said, oh yeah, that would definitely cure diabetes. And I said, oh, you know. And she went, yeah. And I said, so do you recommend that kind of diet to your patients? And she said, oh God, no, most of them wouldn't stick to a diet like that. They'd rather take some pills. And although she's right, I just thought, yeah, but you're not giving them the option, are you? But she's probably right. Most people would rather take the pills and eat the cake, but my dad was fine because my dad liked all food. And whatever you gave him, he loved it, whether it was meat or whatever. I mean, he didn't have the greatest taste buds, to be honest. He was eating a vegan smoked cheese sandwich. Was absolutely convinced it was smoked salmon. So he was happy whatever you gave him. So I did the four articles. The first one was about getting him out of the care home. The second one, I tried to look after him myself for a few weeks and realized it was actually impossible. Number one, we drove each other mad because we hadn't lived together for many, many years. We got on most of the time, but we would bicker quite a lot. And also, he's a big man, and I had to try and get him in and out of the shower and wash him and stuff, and because he was just a little bit helpless. That they kind of infantilize people in care homes as well. They do everything for them, and when, well, they don't. The manager of the care home, I kept saying to her, "Oh, when I get my dad home," and she went, "Oh, he won't be coming home." And I went, "Yes, he will. They don't expect anyone to leave. Once someone's gone into a care home, they expect them to die there." But amazingly, by July of 2020, I said to the manager of the care home, "Have you had a lot of COVID deaths?" Because obviously, we've heard in the press that the care homes are being, and she said none. She said everyone's been fine. So, there were some care homes, obviously there were people were dying and other care homes, but it soon transpired through me talking to, I would say, over 1,000 victims' families now, that these people, even though they were having COVID put on their death certificate, they weren't dying of COVID at all in hospitals and care homes. There was a massive spike in April 2020 of deaths in care homes, and it's transpired now that these deaths were caused by people, the residents and patients being put on end-of-life pathways. One in particular that was brought in April 2020 by the then Health Secretary Matt Hancock, who brought in a protocol for COVID, allegedly, called NG163, NICE Guideline 163, which, when you looked into it, was identical to the abolished Liverpool Care Pathway, which was deemed inhumane and barbaric and was abolished in 2014. Now, that protocol, the Liverpool Care Pathway, consisted of putting people on an end-of-life protocol, which involves starvation, so no food, dehydration, no water, no fluids, withdrawal of essential medications. So, say they were diabetic or whatever, that they would their medications would be taken away, and the administration of end-of-life drugs such as a benzodiazepine, such as midazolam or lorazepam, or anything ending in am. Is generally a benzodiazepine and used concomitantly with an opioid, which is invariably morphine or fentanyl or something along those lines. Now, I realized quite quickly that these drugs are respiratory depressing drugs. They slow down and depress your breathing. So, why were they using those kind of drugs that slow down and can stop eventually your breathing on a so-called respiratory virus? It made no sense. And when you look at those protocols, you're just reading them saying, what the hell? Why would you give that to a person who's got respiratory issues? It's going to kill them. So, and that's exactly what a panel of doctors and professors said to Matt Hancock when he showed them this protocol, saying, look, we're going to implement this. Isn't it great? They all said no. One of them was Professor Sam Ahmadzai, who's the leading palliative care specialist in the world, or one of the leading ones. And he said no. They wrote an article for the he wrote an article for the BMJ, the British Medical Journal. It's still there, you can find it, that says we cannot use this protocol that Matt Hancock is recommending because it's going to kill people. And it was signed by two professors, nine doctors. And Matt Hancock said, thanks very much, and implemented it anyway. And now this was implemented across the board. It seems not in every care home and hospital, but in a lot of care homes and hospitals. I haven't really worked out a geographic sort of pattern to it. All I knew was after I started talking openly about stuff on various podcasts and started writing about stuff, at this point, I was thinking, I tried telling the papers. They were like, not interested, definitely not interested in that. In the same way, they weren't interested a year later when I started sending them jab injury and death stories. They didn't want to know about that either.
Well,
So,
why not?
because, okay, as one editor said to me with the jab injuries, for example, he said, we can't print stories like that because it would jeopardize the vaccine rollout. There was his exact words. And I was like, whoa, okay. So they've been instructed not to run these stories. Now, you must by now have heard of Operation Tala. This was a police operation that actually extended beyond the police, but into hospitals and into the media. If anyone reported, you can find it online, Operation Talla, TALLA. If anyone reported a death in a hospital or a care home, or a death from the vaccine, the so-called vaccine, or an injury, the police were to ignore it. It's out absolutely outrageous. So I could talk about that for hours, but I'm not going to because there's too many other things to talk about. So back in May 2021, I thought this euthanasia story. By then, I'd talked to hundreds of people. I'd set up a support group. I was trying to get the articles in all the papers. So I managed to arrange. One man had all the evidence about his father's murder in several files, and he said he'd come with me to these meetings that I'd set up. So the first meeting was with the news editor of the Daily Mail. He turned up in his little rubber gloves and his little mask, even though we're meeting at an outside restaurant. Well, I'm sitting outside. At first, he was very sneering and cynical, and then he started listening to what I had to say. He looked at the medical records and the drug charts that this guy had, and his jaw was on the table after a couple of hours. He was like, "This is huge," and I said, "I know. That's why I've been trying to get this story to you." And he said, "This is front page news." He said, "This is the story of the century," and I'm like, "I know." And he said, "Yeah, can I take these files?" I said, "Yes, we've got copies of everything." So we gave him the copies and off he went. And then we had a meeting with the medical editor of the Mail on Sunday. Exactly the same reaction. He was like, "This is huge." And I was like, "Yeah, it is. You've got to get in the papers." So he said, "I'd like to speak." I'd set up a support group at this point, had about 20 people in it. I said, "Most of them will talk to you. If you want to talk to any of them, they'll tell you their story. They're absolutely unbelievable what's happened to their loved ones." So he said, "Yeah, I'll definitely talk to someone." This is the Mail on Sunday guy. So he phoned about four or five of them. And so he was gone a few weeks doing that. And then he was quiet. So I chased him up, said, "How's it going? Did you speak to people?" He went, "Yeah, but there's just not really enough evidence, is there?" And I said, "Well, I think there is." I said, "Also, you wrote a story in July 2020, asking, are people in care homes being killed through overuse of sedatives? You actually wrote that article. I've got it here in front of me. So you wrote that 10 months ago when you didn't really have any evidence, particularly. You're just posing a question, because that was something that had been suspected. But now I've got all these people for you. I've got 20 people here who have got the evidence, and you're saying there's not enough evidence." And he just kind of shut the whole thing down, stopped talking to me, ghosted me, and now he works for some, I don't know, pharmaceutical company or something. Doesn't work for the papers anymore. But the other guy, the news editor of the Daily Mail, he went back to the office with all the files, and then I didn't hear from him for a few days. So I thought he's obviously just going through the files. I called him, said, "How's it going?" He was like, "Oh yeah, I'm going to pass it on to someone else. I'm really busy at the moment." I was like, "Okay, get them to call me." And then I kept calling him back after that. Nothing ever came of it. He just went completely silent. But I've not stopped. I send this story out. The more evidence I accrue, obviously, I send out this story every week. I've been doing it for 5 years. They hate me. They're sick of me. Now they just ignore me. It's
I mean, I wonder whether it may be because it's like almost doubly shocking, isn't it? That you've got, first of all, people being starved and having water withheld from them, so they're dehydrating and dying that way, and then also being given drugs to stop them breathing.
Yeah, and these two drugs should never be used concomitantly. They should never be used together because it exacerbates the effect, by many, many times. So, having morphine alone is bad enough. That slows your breathing down. And it was very strange, actually, because people said, "Oh, what made you want to do this and investigate it?" And I did it just because so many people were coming to me. I was thinking, I've got to do something. So I couldn't get it in the papers. And then the CEO of a media company said, "Well, do you want to make it into a film?" And I said, "Well, let's do that." So I gathered together some of the people from my group got a few experts in, and made a film called A Good Death, question mark, which is a reference to the euphemism that they use for euthanasia. They call it a good death. Euthanatos is the original Greek word, meaning a happy death or a good death. And sadly, it's not a good death at all. I mean, the sedative midazolam is the main one we use in this country. They use remdesivir sometimes here as well, but in the US they used remdesivir. Anthony Fauci recommended remdesivir for all hospitals to treat COVID, and it's like, well, that's going to kill them. All the medical trials they've done with remdesivir proved that, like, it destroyed people's kidneys, and liver, and killed them. Yet he recommended it for
I mean, a drug to suppress your breathing sounds as if it's almost deliberately designed to kill you if you've
It
got a
does, doesn't
respiratory
it?
disease.
And then if you go right down that rabbit hole, look at the whole case for eugenics, for depopulation, you'll soon find out that it is completely deliberate. They are coming at us from all angles. They openly admit, as they have to do when you're involved in these kind of processes, they have to put it in plain sight, like any kind of sorcery or black magic, or they have to let the victims know, look, this is what we're going to do. And if you don't complain and go along with it, then you're going to die, obviously. But and if you realize what's going on, just step out of the way. We're going to do it anyway, and you can't stop us. So we made that film that was released in December 21, and I think it's a great film, actually. Even now, I wouldn't change anything. I've never changed my views on any of it from day one.
Well,
From
just remind us of the title.
A Good Death, question mark. It's on Iconic Media, Icknic. And you can find that on, not on YouTube. It was taken down from YouTube because it was way too controversial for God knows who, but they didn't want that on YouTube. And it's on Rumble, actually. Or you can go to Iconic Media and it's there as well. So
Okay, well, what about the other films?
after that, I just thought, I had a bit of a taste for it, and more people are coming to me, and I'm going right down the rabbit hole of how long has this been going on? And then I realized that, democide had been going on for a long, long time. So I thought, well, I'll kind of cap it at 50 years. So my second film was called Playing God, and it was an investigation into medical democide over the last 50 years. Again, I had some case studies. It's a really moving film, and it's beautifully shot. I got two top directors to do it. I had a very strong vision of how I wanted it to look, and they totally got what I wanted and did it exactly. They did it better than I thought they could, but better than my original idea. And a lot of it's in black and white. It's heartrending, it's heartbreaking, and it's horrifying in equal measure. People talking about what's happened. So this was not just about involuntary euthanasia, although it covered it. I mean, the real term we should be using is murder. Involuntary euthanasia is murder. And actually, if you get found putting someone down, shall we say, putting them out of their misery, it's exactly the same punishment, the same jail sentence as you get for murder. So, and because it is murder, so let's call it what it is. But this film also covered a woman whose daughter died in a drug trial that she didn't even know she'd been put on. It talks about a young woman talking about her fiance who took the AstraZeneca jab, and basically his brain exploded. I'm trying to think of a better way of saying, but that's actually what happened. A gorgeous, young guy, and they're about to get married, and he died the most horrendous death because he had this jab. And in fact, she was one of the first people to get compensation for the jab, which is very unusual because they weren't actually married. But she got £120,000 vaccine injury compensation, which has been the same amount since 1979. They've never put that amount up, and she just said it's an insult. The things that that's the price of a life,
Well, and this is another major problem, isn't it? That this compensation money comes from the government, not from the drug companies. So they're not taking any financial risk at all.
Exactly. Yeah. So basically, I think the taxpayers are are paying for it, but it's strange that it's never actually gone up at all since 1979. But yeah, I think it's something like seven, is it 7.5 million? There's not a huge amount of money that's actually been paid out over those years, over the last 40 odd years. And now apparently there's such a huge backlog because of the COVID injection. There's such a huge backlog of people waiting for compensation that most of them won't get it for 15 or 20 years, they've been told. So this girl in my film, she was one of the first to get the compensation, which was pretty amazing. And she was interviewed at the time, by the BBC and by ITV, by everyone. It was all over by the Daily Mail. And so people were starting to talk about it back then. That was, he died in May 21. And yeah, so that film, the thing is, I crowdfunded that film and paid for it out of the money that people donated, and we didn't make a profit. We just about broke even. We got the film out. It's a fantastic film. We had a two film premieres, one in Wales, one in London, which went really, really well. And then I went to put the film on YouTube, and of course, no, another strike. You can't put that on YouTube. So, oh, so I don't know what to do with that film. Well, I didn't know what to do at the time. So UK Column said they'd show it, and Children's Health Defence in America, they've both still got it on. They platformed it for me, but obviously, that's all I can do with it. It's not making any money for anyone. But at least it's still being seen by people around the world, so that's something. But if I could get it on YouTube, it would be better. But strange
Well,
enough,
yeah, but what they do, sorry to disappoint you, is they shadow ban it. So even if you're searching for the exact title, it won't come up in the search. So people just don't find it, even if they're looking for it. And it certainly won't ever pop up on the side of the YouTube page as a recommended thing to watch. So they're very sneaky using their algorithms to make stuff disappear that they find unpalatable.
Well, I'm personally banned constantly. Like back in 2020, between 2020 and 2021, in a 13-month period, I had 11 30-day bans. So basically, I'd do the 30 days, go back on, I could post a picture of a kitten, it didn't have to be anything controversial, and they'd ban me straight away. They'd just see me pop up
Well,
again.
I think you and I must be in the same club. I post an innocuous picture and it suddenly puts a big thing over it saying this is dangerous material. Are you really sure you want to watch it? And that's even if you can see my tweet. But anyway, look, I think we've left a little thread there, which is your dad. What happened with him? How did you get on caring for him?
Well, I couldn't do it. So in the end, I got him carers, and he had a series of carers. Some he didn't like, some he did like. But then in September 21, so he'd been out of the care home for a year. I got a phone call, saying, "Oh, he's kind of like coughing and stuff." I said he's probably eating his breakfast too fast. He did have a habit of eating way too fast. And his carer said, "I don't know, it's a bit weird. He kind of can't catch his breath." And I said, "Okay." She said, "Oh, shall I call an ambulance?" And I said, "Well, call an ambulance. Get them to speak to me as soon as they get there, because I want to make sure they don't try and bump him off, And it sounds paranoid, but by then I knew exactly what was going on. And as my mum used to say, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, which is a very good point. So my dad's carer called an ambulance, and as soon as they got there, I spoke to the young guy. He was called Jason, and I think carer said he was probably about 25 or 26 years old. And so I said to him on the phone, "Can you check my dad's airways? If he needs a bit of oxygen, give him a bit of oxygen, but please don't inject him with anything because he's healthy. He's had a minor stroke, but he's recovering, and." He doesn't need any medication. So, and I'll be there in an hour. So I hopped in the car, and the guy said to me, "What do you mean, no injections?" I said, "Well, just don't inject him with it." He said, "Well, we're thinking of giving a bit of glycopyrronium bromide." And I said, "What's that? I've never heard of it." He said, "It's just to kind of dry up the secretions in the throat a bit. If there's too much moisture being secreted." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, that sounds okay." Little did I know that that's an injection. I thought it would be administered orally, but I didn't know. He said, "Okay, well, we'll give him that." I said, "But don't give him anything else until I get there." And I said, he said, "We're going to make him comfortable." Now, this is a known euphemism that they use, that medics use, paramedics as well, obviously, for giving them the end of life medication. And I said, no, don't make him comfortable. And he said, "Well, you don't want your dad to be comfortable." I said, "No, I know what it means. I know it's a euphemism." I said, "Don't give him any end of life drugs. He's not at the end of his life. Just wait till I get there. I'll be an hour." And I could tell this guy, he didn't like me at all because, because I was sort of bossing him around and telling him what not to do. And he was quite arrogant on the phone to me, actually. I've written about this. And halfway up the motorway, I'd phoned my daughter and said, "Can you just like phone at regular intervals and make sure he's okay and make sure that the paramedics are doing the right thing?" Halfway up the motorway, my daughter calls and she said, "He's gone." And I'm like, "Who's gone where?" And she said, "Granddad." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "He's dead." And I went, "What do you mean he's dead? There's nothing wrong with him." She said, "I don't know, but he's dead." And so I pulled over into Clackett Lane Services. And it was on this particular day where it was the petrol. Do you remember that one day where there was no petrol and all the petrol stations had shut down? And this is the 24th of September 2021. It's a Friday. And I pulled over and looked, thought, "I've got half a tank of petrol. Is that going to be enough to get me there and back?" Anyway, I was half thinking that. This female paramedic came to the phone when I called. And she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry about for the loss of your." And I went, No, never mind all that. What did you give him? What did you give him?" And she said, "Oh, no, we didn't give him anything." I said, "So what happened?" She went, "Oh, he just died." And I'm like, "Well, what did he die of?" And she said, I don't know. We didn't have time to give him anything." Now, my dad's carer had been eavesdropping. They'd made everyone go out of the room. But my dad's carer had been eavesdropping through the partially open door. She heard them discussing midazolam, whether they should give him 5 milligrams or 10 milligrams. And when she went back into the room, she said his arm was out over the covers of his bed and his sleeve rolled up. So she thought they'd give. So she said, "Did you give him an injection?" And they said, "No." So, and apparently, after they gave him this injection, whatever it was, he had a fatal reaction to it and was dead within minutes. So I asked for the ambulance records. Meanwhile, I'm sitting at the service station thinking, if I go to the house, I might not be able to get back. We didn't know how long this petrol shortage was going to go on for. I don't know what. Maybe I should just go straight home. And I thought, well, if he's actually dead, and several people there had confirmed at this point that he was dead. In my state of shock, I just drove back home. I got the ambulance report and everything about it was wrong. It said there were six paramedics there. They were all names I didn't recognize. It said weird things about me, like I didn't come to the house because I didn't want to see a dead body and all this sort of nonsense. And the daughter, told us that she didn't want him to be comfortable and all this sort of stuff. And on the on one of anyway, I said to the ambulance service, "Can you send me the correct records? Because these are all completely wrong, Then they sent me another set of records, which again had loads of discrepancies and contradictions. And, you're in this kind of shocked state reading, and you're like, what did they give him? And so it said on one of the records they gave him 20 milligrams of glycopyrronium bromide, which he'd never had in his life. So how would they know what kind of reaction he would have to it? Sometimes there is a fatal reaction to that. They didn't titrate it. If you're giving anyone a drug that they've not had before, if they're naive to a drug, you have to titrate. Like when you go to the dentist and they give you a little tiny bit first, see how it does that work. We'll give you a little bit more, a little bit more. That's what they should do with any drug that a person hasn't had before. But they obviously just whacked him with the 20 milligrams and then he was dead. But whether it actually was glycopyrronium bromide or whether it was midazolam or whether it was something else, we don't know. So when they'd all left and my dad's body's still there in the bed, I said to his carer, "Look around, see if there's any evidence of any injection, any syringe anywhere or anything." And she looked everywhere and she found it in the outside bin, a syringe wrapper, which I've still got in my office here. which proves that they had taken a syringe out of a wrapper. That's all it proved, obviously. So I thought, okay, my dad has clearly been killed. There's something not right here. He was 78 years old. It turned out that the paramedics rang my dad's GP because they didn't know what to do with him. My dad's GP wasn't there. So they spoke to another GP that didn't know my dad at all. And this GP gave the paramedics wrong information. They said my dad was dying of terminal cancer, that he was having palliative care, and he hadn't got much longer to go. None of that was true. He didn't have cancer. He wasn't having palliative care. He was recovering from a stroke and was only 78 at this point. So I phoned my dad's GP on the Monday. She was in shock. She was like, I can't believe he's dead. What happened? And I said, well, I was going to ask you the same. And she said, well, he was fine. And I said, I know. I said, but somebody at the surgery told the paramedics that my dad was terminally ill. And they acted on that. They believed that it was their right, knowing that this man had a terminal illness, which he didn't have, but they believed he had, that it was their right then to kill him, put him out of his misery, poor old thing. And these were kids. The girl paramedic was 21. She was called an advanced paramedic. I know her now. I've got a picture of her on my phone because I looked her up straight away. I never contacted her because I was too upset, and also I just didn't think it was the right thing to do. 21 years old, little sweet face on a little child almost. And yeah, that's what happened to my dad.
Well, it's horrific, isn't it? And also, I'd imagine that there's all sorts of possibilities for suing, but is it something that anyone would actually really want to do?
Operation Teller. Operation Teller. The police were told not to. So I phoned the police, said my dad, I think my dad's been killed. And they took some notes, said, okay, we'll look into it. Didn't say directly, oh, we're not going to look into that at all. And I phoned them back a few weeks after and said, do you want me to write a statement? And they said, well, there's no point you writing a statement because you weren't there. So it's just hearsay. And I was like, no, but I can write a statement what I
No,
did.
but look, you were on the phone. I mean, the police are sounding absolutely useless, Jackie.
8 months later, I said, what's happening with this investigation? They said, oh, we've closed it. I said, why? And they said, well, we investigated it and everything's fine and above board. And I was like, well, what do you mean? You haven't even spoken to me properly about it yet. Who have you interviewed? Did you interview the paramedics? No. Did you speak to my dad's GP? No. Oh, we spoke to the carer, but she didn't say very much. And we spoke to a family member who turned up, and they said everything was fine and that you were overreacting. And I was like, okay. So they didn't want to look into it. They just pretended to investigate it. So at that point, I thought, I haven't got enough evidence to do anything, right? And the police aren't helping. So I turned my attention at that point to helping the people that did have evidence, because I thought, at least if we can, but then the problems that all these people are faced with, they're taking on the government, they're taking on the NHS, who've got an endless pit of money and resources. And if you're one person or one family up against that, so there's one case that's happening at the moment, and the verdict is going to be, I've been to a lot of the court sessions, the court hearings, it was an inquest, and it was actually the guy, the man is called Del Dimmock, the victim, and we're going to find out in February the verdict, but that's been going on for 5 years. He died in
Well,
2020.
anyway, one of the most important things to do, of course, is to be tooling people up to deal with situations like this. So, beforehand, if possible, can you just remind listeners about of your book, whereabouts, and most importantly, whereabouts to get it?
Yeah, I just wanted to say quickly, the reason that people can't take it any further is money, usually, because you have to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds to even get to the inquest stage. And also, lawyers don't want to take it on because they don't want to go up against the government and the NHS. There's not much chance of winning. But anyway, so yeah, my book, Murdered by the State, the 42 real life harrowing accounts of what happened to these poor people's loved ones. It's available now. I'll send you the link. I know this is a radio show, isn't it? Thinking of the best way to do it. It is on Amazon, but it's better if you order through this particular link. But If you look up Murdered by the State on Amazon, you can order it there. But ordering through Amazon means that my publisher doesn't have any control
Well,
of it.
look, what we'll do is I'll just get a link from you afterwards and I'll give that as part of on the show itself rather than right now. But anyway, Jackie D Boy, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.